what we do, we refer to as goal-focused and planning-driven. And the reality is, one of the biggest problems with investing in our culture is that we are very market-focused and performance-driven. Mm-hmm. What that means is we're very tied to, you know, what works right now and headlines and the latest media stories. And in the US, you see that in things like the GameStop, the AMC thing that just happened, the NFTs that are being traded. You see that in a lot of the cryptocurrency things that are being traded. You see that when people are paying really, really close attention to what's going on right now, but they're ignoring the fact that the research tells us that what's going on right now doesn't necessarily help you long term. And that the more you focus on what's going on right now, the less likely you will be successful long term. The more you chase what's hot today, the less likely you'll be long term successful in your investing.
Welcome to this edition of Retire Well, Retire Happy with your host, Annie Nelson, an Australian look at reinventing yourself for retirement and getting yourself retirement ready. It's always fascinating getting to know what people are getting up to in retirement, how they are supplementing their incomes, pensions, where they have chosen to live, how they are filling their time, what charities they are supporting, and what adventures they are having. Anne will also talk to experts in their fields, including investing, health, estate planning, financial advisors, and seniors' health care.
Hi, welcome back to the Retire Well, Retire Happy show with your host, Annie Nelson. And today we have a special guest, and his name is Jonathan Dio.
Well done.
And he is the best-selling author of Mindful Money, Simple Practices for Reaching Your Financial Goals and Increasing Your Happiness Dividend. He writes and speaks about the intersection between life and money. He has been investing for 40 years and been a financial advisor for 25. He started his firm in 2001 and is a believer in financial literacy education and an advocate for the fiduciary standard. And Jonathan also has experience with going from lack to abundance and from unhealthy to healthy. So welcome to the show.
Thanks. I didn't know it was Annie. I had Anne written down. My daughter's name is Annie. And I'm really happy to be here.
No, there's too many Anne Nelsons in the world, but my second name is actually Edith, so it's Annie Nelson.
Oh, got it.
But I did have an old lady, friend of my mother's, that used to call me Annie Oakley or something like that, or Annie Get Your Gun, so yeah.
That's Annie Oakley, right? That's the same.
Okay. You have had a different background into coming into being a financial guru. And that came, I think, from how you have included in the words of your introduction, happiness dividend. Would you like to take us back a bit and talk to us about your early days and where you came from and where you ended up?
Sure. The arc goes from Rapid City, South Dakota, born into relatively modest means, through Montana State University, that's where I went to college, through grad school in Berkeley, California, where I studied comparative religion. I came out to Berkeley, California to study to be a Lutheran seminarian. So I was studying to be a Lutheran minister when I started out. And I shifted gears from there to switch to Buddhist phenomenology or sort of Buddhist philosophy. I was an academic studying comparative religion with a focus on Buddhism. And 3 years into my master's program, my wife said that she thought it was her turn to go to school. So I said, okay, I'll go find a job. And I went back to something I was interested in when I was 9 and 10 years old, which was investing. Because we didn't have any money, I was always very interested in money and studied investing and studied small business. And so I interviewed at Dean Witter in the United States, and Dean Witter hired me and became a salesman for one of the Wall Street firms, and then went through like 7 different Wall Street firms in about 5 years until I started my own firm in 2001. And that kind of brings us full circle to where we are. Well, the last 20 years, but independent, doing financial advising for families.
And has your investing style changed? Because I see you've been an investor for longer than you have been an advisor.
Yeah. So I bought my first stock when I was 9 years old. And I really thought from like 9 through teenage years through college, even when I was starting off at Dean Witter, I thought that, you know, I could pick stocks better. I thought that, you know, somebody that studied it really carefully could actually do a better job by picking businesses that would be successful. And I think that that is largely illusory. I think that's a joke now. I don't think anyone can do that. I think that the best thing you can do is actually, you know, and we may talk about this in a bit, plan appropriate asset allocation, broad diversification, and then consistent rebalancing. I think those are three markers of how it should be done. But I've done it every way, from individual stocks to option trading to picking individual funds to, you know, mirroring managers to mirroring Warren Buffett to I've tried all kinds of things, and I've kind of found the place where I think is more predictable long-term outcomes.
So practice makes perfect. In these times of COVID, do you see that that's going to make any long-term changes to family finances? And are you recommending different strategies now to what you would have been?
I think there's definitely going to be a long-term effect on things, primarily if you are somebody that lost a job or lost means of an income for your family. I think there's definitely a challenge for that. And I think that the thing that's going to come out of it in the United States specifically, and we've kind of already seen the pendulum begin to swing, is we were very, and this is for 40, 50 years, for many, 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 many years, we've been very focused on providing rewards to capital. And I think that we're shifting towards providing more rewards to labor. I mean, that'll be better benefits. That'll be different ways to provide safety nets and those kinds of things I think are going to be there. At the same time, I think we're going to tax capital more. We're going to go through this for the next year or so with our new president, and he's going to come up with different means of taxation. And I think that we're going to have a different structure for the ongoing future than we have in the past. And I think that that's probably a good thing for us. I know that there's a lot of people that'll disagree with that, but I think that we have really, and I'm a beneficiary of that. I have really low taxes. I make, you know, I didn't lose my job. I could make substantial money through the whole pandemic. And I think that a lot of people can't say that. And I think that there needs to be a little bit more fairness in that process. I think that's one of the long-term changes that we see from the pandemic, is we see finally labor is going to have a better seat at the table, partially because of the pandemic, partially because of the election, and just the electorate in the United States is changing.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting, however, when you're trying to plan for your golden years, that successive governments do change the goalposts, and it must be frustrating for a lot of people and planners to continue to plan for the future when the goalposts do get changed.
It's not just different, you know, governments or regimes that change the goalposts. We change them ourselves too. Like, I remember when I first started the industry, I thought, you know, if I had $50 million under management, you know, $50 million of client money that I could manage, I would feel successful. But then it went to $100 million, and now it's, you know, 300 and something million. And so I move my own goalposts, partially because life gets more expensive, partially because, you know, when you're 20, you don't really know what to expect when you're 50. And then when you're 50, you don't really know what to expect when you're 70. You don't really understand the changes you're going to go through those last 10,000 days of life until you start those last 10,000 days and start feeling that. So it's an interesting conundrum.
I don't think too many 20-year-olds would be thinking about being 50, but I think once you get to over 60, you may start thinking about it a lot more. So you're not so much goal-focused, but planning-driven. So would you like to explain that to us?
So what we do, we refer to as goal-focused and planning-driven. And the reality is, one of the biggest problems with investing in our culture is that we are very market-focused and performance-driven. Mm-hmm. What that means is we're very tied to, you know, what works right now and headlines and the latest media stories. And in the US, you see that in things like the GameStop, the AMC thing that just happened, the NFTs that are being traded. You see that in a lot of the cryptocurrency things that are being traded. You see that when people are paying really, really close attention to what's going on right now, but they're ignoring the fact that the research tells us that what's going on right now doesn't necessarily help you long term. And that the more you focus on what's going on right now, the less likely you will be successful long-term. The more you chase what's hot today, the less likely you'll be long-term successful in your investing. And so we try to remove that market focus and remove that performance drive for today's performance and really think on, you know, what are your goals? What are the plans to get there? Let's put those plans into place and just follow those plans. And I think that that gives us levers that we can pull that support long-term better decisions.
Long-term better decisions will be set us up financially in the end. Do you find most people find money a source of stress?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I don't think it matters. You know, I've got clients that don't have tremendous amounts of wealth, and I've got clients that have tremendous amounts of wealth. I think in both cases, there's stress. There's different kinds of stress. But if you don't have a lot of money, then you're always worried about getting money. If you have a lot of money, you're always worried about losing money, or you're worried about your money ruining your kids. That's, I think, the thing I hear more than anything else is, how will this affect my children? That's a great question, because if kids don't learn to like limit, they grow up with huge expectations. They grow up, you know, being disappointed with how the world actually works. That's important. And we learn these lessons before we know we're learning lessons. We learn lessons about money. And most people don't have any formal lessons. It's all like stories that grandparents tell, stories that parents tell, or arguments you watch parents have. And that creates a lot of stress around, what are we supposed to do about money?
Because we often ask the wrong people, or we're listening to the wrong people, like you said before about the news and what's happening now, or the barber, or the person over the back fence.
Right.
Do you think, we're talking about families and children, do you think that there is pressure on parents these days that they have to provide a certain standard for their children and provide, have something left for them in the future? Is that really a stress thing as well?
So I have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old, and I can tell you that we can say up front, you know, what my kids want from me shouldn't matter, but they don't, you know, they're smart. They don't say, hey, dad, I'd really like this thing. What they say is, hey, dad, all my friends have this thing. And so we have this competition around, and we're not competing with other parents, but it's like, we're all setting the bar a little bit higher and a little bit higher and a little bit higher. And that's why you get, I mean, my kids are growing up in one of the wealthiest places in the world, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And, you know, kids, parents buy their kids new cars when they're 16. And that's, I don't understand that. Kids don't work. Like I worked when I was 12. My kids worked when they were 12. My son has a job in a very difficult high school. He's going to a very difficult high school. He's got a job. He works 12 to 16 hours a week. None of his peers do that. It's because his peers' parents give him money. And he goes, why don't you give me money? I'm like, well, that's, you know, I turn out to be a mean parent because I'm not just giving him everything. And that's, I think, a better lesson, but it's hard. It's hard as a parent to hear your kids say, how come you don't do this? Everyone else's parents do this. It's hard.
It's interesting when we have to sort of plan for the future, but still focus on now. The decisions we make now will affect our future. So we can't sort of be, do we worry about the future, or we spend more time focusing on what we're actually doing now? And you talk about plan-appropriate investing, so that's interesting. How would we get successful at investing? How would you explain that?
The plan-appropriate? So if you think about the idea of being goal-focused and planning-driven, the idea is understanding what your trade-offs are first. There's an enormous amount of research that says that people who try to beat the markets fail the more longer that they try to beat the markets, right? So with that being said, it's like, okay, so how do you build a portfolio that you don't have to think about as much today, and how much risk should you take? And that all requires us knowing what you're trying to accomplish and knowing how much you can save out of the resources you have coming in, and then making trade-offs, like knowing that if I'm, you know, if I want to have the retirement income that I can't outlive, then maybe I I can't pay for 100% of my kids' college education. Or if I do pay for 100% of my kids' college education, how much longer do I have to work to create that retirement income stream? It's understanding the trade-offs and making the trade-offs up front so that you're not surprised at the back end. And that's how you create, that's how you understand how much risk you should take. And you may want to tweak it up. You may want to take more risk. You may want a higher return than that once it comes down to it. But knowing how much you should take or how much you need to take to make sure that the ends that you're seeking come true, that's what plan appropriate is you shouldn't have a portfolio without a plan. You should know what the money you're investing is for, knowing when it's needed, knowing how much it's needed, when it's needed. That plan drives how it's invested.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's wise advice.
I hope.
You're an author, a best-selling author of the book called Mindful Money, Simple Practices for Reaching Your Financial Goals. I see that you also are an educator offering life stage courses on from your website. So would you like to talk to us now about your book and your courses that you offer?
Sure. So the book was published in 2017. The book itself has three different parts. These kind of dovetail with how we think about working with people around their money. The first step is really in the first section of the book is about uncovering all the lies that all the illusions, all the falsehoods that Wall Street, the media, and frankly, our own brains tell us about money and the decisions we have to make. There's a lot that just gets that's flying at us all the time that we can ignore, but it feels like it's really important to watch and pay attention to. The first part of the book is just about debunking those myths. The middle part of the book, and this is where you bring some of the history of comparative religion and Buddhism and psychology in from my own background, it's about understanding what the neuroscientists, the psychologists, the monks, the ministers, the pastors, the philosophers for thousands of years have written down and talked about what makes life worth living, what makes well-being, what creates happiness, how do you get to a happiness dividend? And that is the sources of happiness are actually pretty simple. They're things like relationships, health, you know, lifelong learning. It's not money, 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 money. It's not more, 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 more of anything. It's the things that the philosophers have been talked about for thousands of years. If you understand what those things are, then you can sort of figure out what is my brand of happiness? What is it that is going to be additive in my life? And then the third part of the book is, okay, now that you know what not to think or believe in terms of decisions you have to make, and you kind of understand what your brand of happiness is, now the next step pretty simply is how do I build a financial plan on that? How do I make that the goal of my financial plan? And so the third section of the book is those steps towards creating the financial plan. Now, at the end of every chapter in the book, there's an exercise. And if you go through every exercise, right, and at the end of the book, you actually have a financial plan. That was the intent of the book, is to give people for $15 or $10 or wherever, however much it costs the book, people can have a financial plan that they do themselves. It's rudimentary. It's on paper. It's simple, but they can do it themselves without a planner, and they can have an understanding of the trade-offs they need to make. Now, when I ask people if they do those exercises, they say, no, they don't do the exercises. So the courses are designed to support people in doing those exercises.
Right. So if anyone wanted to find out more about you, your firm, and the courses that they can do online, I believe, where would they go?
I mean, the best place to go is to go to the website itself, and it's mindful.money. There's no .com or no .edu, or it's just mindful.money. And if you go to the financial education tab, it'll tell you about the financial education courses that we have. And if you go to the sort of services tab, it'll tell you about the personal services that we offer.
Thank you. It's been interesting chatting with you today. And it's great to see that someone can use their spiritual practice to help guide them into a financial practice. And would you like to talk about, as we finish up, your burning desire?
Absolutely. I would love to actually change the way we think about money, in especially my culture. I think money, you know, we have financialized everything. And I think that that's a mistake. I think that we create a lot of stress. We create a lot of depression. We create a lot of anxiety around things that they don't have to carry the power that they carry. And that's because we've put money at the front and center of everything. And I think that if we can focus on the things, if we can change the narrative, we can provide the basics, and we can help people be less stressed about money, I think we all have a better life. So if I can change that narrative, I'd be all for it.
Well, thanks very much. It's been great having you on the Retire Well, Retire Happy show today. And I hope we've inspired people to be more mindful with their money and their practices.
Thanks, Anne.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to the podcast show of Retire Well, Retire Happy with your host, Annie Nelson. For more information on the show's guests and being retirement ready, pop on over to my website, www.annnelson.com.au, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Until next time, be happy, stay healthy, and help somebody.